Hello, and welcome back to PaleoCast. I'm Liz Martin, and on this episode, we'll be talking about ankylosaurs, the armored dinosaurs. But before we get into ankylosaurs, I wanted to talk a little bit about conferences. There are two big paleontology-related conferences coming up: the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology in Dallas and the Geological Society of America in Baltimore. Conferences are really important to us at PaleoCast because they allow us to cover recent paleontology studies and research before they're even published and before they make it into the news. This lets us give our listeners up-to-date information about what's really going on in the field right now, and we think that this is a very valuable resource, and hope you do too. We'll be covering both of these meetings in person, so if you're at these conferences and want to speak to us, come say hi. Now on to ankylosaurs. I spoke with Dr. Victoria Arbour, a postdoctoral scholar at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences. I've known Victoria for a few years now, first meeting her when I was an undergraduate at the University of Alberta, and she was demonstrating in one of my courses while she was working on her master's degree on ankylosaurs. She then moved on to do a PhD at the U of A and has focused on looking at the tail club and evolution of ankylosaurs. Now, as a postdoc in North Carolina, she's continuing her research on ankylosaurs, but also looking at some other animals as well. In this episode, we discuss ankylosaur evolution and biology, as well as focusing on some of Victoria's most recent research, including a very recent study on the evolution of the tail club. We hope you enjoy this episode. Hi, Victoria. Thanks for joining us to talk about ankylosaurs today. Can you give us a little bit of a background about yourself and kind of how you ended up where you are now and how you got into ankylosaurs?
Sure thing. So I am currently a postdoctoral researcher at North Carolina State University and the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences. And before I moved down here last year, I was a PhD student at the University of Alberta. And prior to that, a master's student at the University of Alberta, which is where I sort of got started on studying ankylosaurs, which has proven to be a very like fruitful and interesting line of inquiry. So I'm very happy about that. So I first became interested in the group because I wanted to work on something that it didn't seem like had received a lot of attention before. So I spent a lot of time reading and looking for gaps in our knowledge and gaps in the scientific literature. And I ended up finding ankylosaurs as kind of that gap. It's not like nothing had been written about them before, but in particular, there hadn't really been a whole lot written about their tail clubs. So this really cool structure that's like probably the most charismatic thing about the group as a whole really had very little sort of scientific inquiry gone into it. So I thought that would be a pretty cool thing for me to work on, and I ended up looking at the biomechanics of their tail club swinging, which worked out as a really nice master's research project. And from there, I just wound up with like a billion more questions every time I answered one of my projects. So I'm still working on them. That's kind of my story.
I guess before we get started and get into it too much, can you kind of explain what ankylosaurs are for those people who maybe don't recognize that word or know exactly what they are?
Well, ankylosaurs are the best dinosaurs, clearly. These are the armored four-legged herbivores. The most distinctive feature is really their armor. And the armor is a special kind of bone called an osteoderm. So these are little bones that form right in the skin, in the dermis, the sort of lower layer of your skin. And modern animals can have osteoderms. In fact, there's lots of animals that have osteoderms, things like alligators and crocodiles, armadillos, some kinds of lizards. So osteoderms are present in other groups, but I feel like they're sort of most interesting in ankylosaurs because ankylosaurs, I think, have the greatest diversity of shapes and sizes and textures on those osteoderms. So they can have big spikes, or they can have sort of flat triangular shapes along the sides of their bodies, or they can have little pebbles and knobs. And in part, that's partly what contributes to their tail club, that sort of stiff cliff-axe-like structure at the end of their tail that we find in some species. So besides that, they've got these spikes. They've got sort of short, squat heads in some groups. Other ones have long snouts. They tend to have sort of wide, low-slung bodies. Some people talk about them being like walking coffee tables, which I think is a pretty good description. And their teeth are really neat because they just have these small little leaf-shaped teeth, and they're really quite small even compared to their overall like head size and body size for an herbivore. So they're pretty. There's a lot of really weird things about ankylosaurs. I'm going to talk about tails a lot today, but there's a lot of things that are really weird about them just overall. They're a really cool group to work on.
When did the first ankylosaurs evolve?
The very first ankylosaurs are kind of hard to identify, much like lots of other groups of dinosaurs. The further back in time you go and the further down the evolutionary tree you go towards the base, the harder it is to pinpoint exactly where the first of something is. But some of the earliest fossils are fragmentary specimens from the UK, pieces of jaw, pieces of skull from about the middle Jurassic.
Okay.
So they show up pretty early on, but we don't really know a lot about Jurassic ankylosaurs as a whole. They're really rare. They're not really abundant parts of their ecosystems, and they're not particularly big at that time either. So the fossil record for ankylosaurs really takes off in the early Cretaceous and through the end of the Mesozoic, the end of the Age of Dinosaurs.
Do we know how they relate to other dinosaurs at all?
Yes. So ankylosaurs are most closely related to the other group of osteoderm-bearing herbivores, the stegosaurs. So hopefully everybody is familiar with Stegosaurus and the other species of stegosaurs that exist. So they're the closest relatives. Together they form a group called Thyreophora, which is pretty cool. And then more broadly, they're part of the sort of herbivorous dinosaur radiation called Ornithischia.
Okay. I think in general, people who know about ankylosaurs might think that there's sort of only one or two species, but how many species of ankylosaur were there that we know of?
That's a great question, because part of what I've had to do is figure out how many species there are. So a big part of my research for my PhD was looking at the diversity of one group of ankylosaurs called ankylosaurids. But there's well over 40 species of known ankylosaurs, so the group as a whole, with a lot of diversity. So like I said, that we've sort of got two major clades of ankylosaurs. We've got ankylosaurids, that's the group that eventually has a tail club, although not all members of that group do. And then we've also got the notosaurids, which have sort of long snouts, slightly less ornamented skulls, but some of them tend to have really huge shoulder spikes and sort of fused up armor across their pelvis. So they're pretty cool too. Most of the work I've done is on ankylosaurids.
I guess that would make sense if you mostly do tail club stuff, if the others don't have tails.
But I'm starting to spend a bit more time looking at notosaurids too. I'm looking at sort of the fossil record of notosaurids and ankylosaurids in North America in relation to the Western Interior Seaway, so that huge body of water that covers up the middle part of North America. So I'm starting to look a bit more at notosaurids, but my expertise at the moment, I would say, lies with ankylosaurids.
So you've kind of mentioned a little bit about the osteoderms and armor. Is that how most of the species are distinguished? Is how the kind of armor is different between different animals? Is that, I guess, how you pick out species?
Yeah, that's definitely a big part of it. One of the things that is really useful is actually looking at sort of the ornamentation pattern on the skull when you've got a good skull. So that's how I'm able to tell apart a lot of the North American species. They have these kind of boulder-like heads with these interesting little tile-like patterns on them. And you can actually tell them apart looking at those patterns, looking at the shapes and textures, and looking at things like the shape of the horns at the black corners of their skull. Okay. Looking at the armor that sits on their neck is especially helpful, because we know sort of the position of the osteoderms relative to each other, because they fuse up into this yolk-like structure. So we definitely can tell the difference in some ways. Part of the problem is that ankylosaurs are often known from very fragmentary specimens. And because their armor changes shape across their body, it also makes it hard to know if a sort of isolated osteoderm is a different shape from another one because it's from a different place on the body or it's because it's from a different species. So that's one thing that makes them kind of challenging to work on at times.
If most of the fossils are fragmentary, where can you get good fossilized ones? Are there places where you get an entire ankylosaur?
Yes, definitely. There are great ankylosaur specimens out there. There are some awesome ones from Alberta, from the Dinosaur Park Formation, and one of them is on display at the Natural History Museum in London. It's from an animal called Scolosaurus, and it has basically all of the armor in place, and it has skin impressions, but it's missing a head and a tail club. It's so frustrating. It's just like the worst. It's so good, except for those two things. So there are some really great ones from there. The Terrell Museum in Alberta also collected an amazing specimen that they're preparing right now from the early Cretaceous of Alberta from the tar sands, which I see them posting updates about on social media, and I'm very excited for them to work on that and get it described because it looks pretty cool. And then another place that's really great for finding ankylosaurs is actually the Gobi Desert in Mongolia. So in the Gobi Desert, a lot of the dinosaurs were preserved in really weird situations where they lived in a kind of duney environment. So there were lots of sand dunes around. And sometimes those sand dunes, it looks like they collapsed on animals that were still alive. So basically animals got buried alive sometimes during these really bad storms. And that means that you get whole animal preserved. They were sort of buried before they could be scavenged or washed apart by like running water, like streams or rivers. So sometimes we get really great specimens from the Gobi Desert in sort of crouching life positions. It's wow. Actually kind of grim and sad because the dinosaurs like obviously were like suffocating to death and they were trying to get out. So it's a little bit sad, but it's great for paleontologists nowadays because you can like learn so much from them. One of the really cool fossils from the Gobi Desert is a cluster of baby ankylosaurs from a species called Pinacosaurus. And they were actually kind of huddled up next to each other, crouched down before they were buried and died. So we know that juveniles at least spent time around each other in clusters, at least part of the time, because of that particular set of fossils that we found.
Wow, that's really impressive. I don't think I've heard of that one, so that's pretty cool.
It's pretty cool. That's something that was found during the Canada-China Dinosaur Project back in the 1980s.
Wow. Going back to the specimen you mentioned from the tar sands, that, if I remember correctly, was found during an excavation. Like it was found by like a construction worker or something.
Yeah. So I'm not totally familiar with the process for extracting tar sands, but it involves a lot of heavy machinery. And yeah, one of the workers saw a block fall down with weird looking fossils in it, and he recognized them as being unusual, and then they called in the Terrell Museum. It's kind of weird because it's in marine sediment, so we expect it to be something more like an ichthyosaur or plesiosaur or something that's like you know, one of these marine reptiles, but it turns out that it was this really nice complete ankylosaur. So I think that's going to be a really cool fossil and a really great story to tell once that specimen is described.
Yeah, and I think that's completely 3D, and they think it's like an almost complete specimen, isn't it?
Yeah. And from the pictures that you see, but they've got it in their sort of a windowed preparation lab, and it looks like it's turning into a really awesome specimen. So good job, you guys.
I definitely look forward to seeing that one. But I guess now we can talk about tail clubs a little bit, since we've sort of talked about what ankylosaurs are, and I know that's what you've done most of your work on. So when most people think of ankylosaurs, I think that tail clubs are one of the first things that kind of comes to mind. So can you tell us a little bit about how the tail club is formed and what this club is?
Sure. So tail clubs are really cool biological structures that don't really have any modern analogs. We don't have any animals around today that really have a structure quite like that. Part of what's really neat about ankylosaur tail clubs is that they use kind of two different skeletal systems. So they use the vertebrae of the tail and those osteoderms that sit in the skin to form this kind of like two-part structure on their tail, which I think is really cool. So the tail vertebrae are really, really different compared to any other dinosaur tails. They become very long. They have all of the little processes that sit on the top of the vertebra as part of the neural arch sort of lengthen and become really robust and lock together. And the same thing happens with the chevrons or the hemal arch underneath the tail. So you get this really locked together structure. If you look at it from the top, it actually looks like a series of V's all nested together, which is really cool. So it's really distinctive. Once you've seen one, I think you would definitely recognize one like forever and ever afterwards. So that's what the vertebrae do, which is really cool. So they have all these changes to the vertebrae. And then at the end of the tail, they get some of those osteoderms sort of wrapping around the tip of the tail. There's always two really big ones, and then there's kind of a variable number of small ones right at the very tip of it, and they get really huge sometimes. So some of them are pretty small. Some of the like knobs of bone at the end are maybe only like 15 or 20 centimeters wide, but the biggest ones are more than 60 centimeters wide, so more than half a meter of bone. And that is a lot of bone to carry at the end of your tail. So
yeah,
it's a totally weird thing to have evolved, and just a really cool structure.
Something that had a tail club that big, if you were looking at an animal with a club of 60 centimeters wide, how big would that animal have been?
What's interesting is that some of the ones with the biggest tail clubs don't look like they had much bigger bodies. Hmm. So one of the problems that I've run into is that we have a lot of isolated tail clubs and not a lot of like whole bodies with a tail club, unfortunately. The worst example is that specimen of Scolosaurus, because it's like the whole animal, but not the tail club. But when I've compared different tail clubs, and you can look at things like the width of the vertebrae in that handle, that sort of stiff part of the tail club made up of the vertebrae, the width of that doesn't really change as the knob, the sort of osteoderm mass, gets bigger. So one of these ankylosaurs that has a 60 centimeter wide knob doesn't have much bigger vertebrae than one with, say, like 20 or 40 centimeter wide tail club knob. So that's pretty weird. And I don't really know why that is. That seems kind of odd to me. It might be that the tail club knob is still growing throughout the animal's life. Maybe it's more of a symbol of maturity, or say like reproductive maturity. We just don't have enough specimens of complete skeletons to really be able to say a lot about some of these questions about like size and how it changes through the life of an animal, or even how it varies across species sometimes, which is very frustrating for me, but leaves lots of questions to be answered as we get new specimens.
So are there not currently any kind of series known for a juvenile and kind of a sub-adult and an adult tail club from the same species?
That's a great question. So part of the problem is that we have lots of great juvenile specimens for Pinacosaurus, that little guy from the Gobi. Those little ones, they have the sort of stiff tail, the handle vertebrae at the end of the tail, but they don't have any knob osteoderms. In fact, it looks like ankylosaurs don't actually get osteoderms across their body until they're at least a couple of years old. Because those specimens from the Gobi, they have little tiny millimeter-sized like ossicles on their bodies, but no really big osteoderms past their neck. So that's interesting too. And you'd think that that would be a great species to figure out what's going on with their growth and ontogeny, but the problem is that there's almost no adult specimens known.
Oh, really?
So that makes it really tough to answer any of these questions. The only other ankylosaurs where we have a good sample size of specimens are the Alberta ankylosaurs. And we used to call all of those ankylosaurs Euoplocephalus, but some of the work that I've done has shown that that's actually four different species. So instead of having this really great sample size for Euoplocephalus, we have like a pretty good sample size for Euoplocephalus and an okay sample size for Anodontosaurus and a not very good sample size for Scolosaurus and Dioplosaurus. So I kind of ruined that. Plus, we didn't have any really small individuals for those ones. Okay. So we have like good-ish sample sizes for some of these things, but we're just like not quite there yet for being able to answer a few of those questions.
How does a structure like that evolve?
So that is the most recent paper that I published. That was the question that I wanted to know, is how did ankylosaurs get their tail club? So the tail club is only found really in a very small subset of ankylosaurs as a whole. It's only found in the ankylosaurid ankylosaurs, and within the ankylosaurids, it's only found in a relatively derived group within that. So not all ankylosaurids have a tail club. So my question was, where within that group do we see the first tail clubs, the sort of earliest ones? And I also wanted to know if we saw both parts of the tail club evolve at the same time. So we've got the handle, the sort of stiffened vertebrae, and the knob, the really large bulbous osteoderm. So we have like two parts, and I was like, do those show up at the same time, or does the handle come before the knob, or does the knob come before the handle, or can we just not answer that question right now at all? So as I was doing my PhD research, sort of untangling how many species there were and how the relationships of the different ankylosaurids could be plotted out, I also kept my eye open for tail material across ankylosaurids and tried to think about what I would expect to see in the fossil record under different scenarios. So what sort of features would we expect to see first to support like one hypothesis versus another? And one of the things that I found was that we can see the lengthening of the processes on the top of the vertebra, part of the neural arch, well before we see enlargement of the osteoderms at the tip of the tail as it's preserved in the fossil record. So based on the specimens that I've got, it looks like that lengthening and stiffening of the tail vertebrae appears long before that knob of bone, which I've found is really what a lot of people think of when they think of a tail club. They're just thinking of that ball of bone at the end of the tail. And I think there's a couple of reasons for that. For one thing, when you're looking at a drawing of an ankylosaur, like in a picture book, you don't see the skeletal structure underneath, obviously, if they've got like a nice sort of fleshed out diagram. So you can't really see that there's actually something going on with the vertebrae as well. The other thing is a lot of people tend to draw their ankylosaurs with like scorpion tails, where the tail is like raised up over the heads, like bopping a tyrannosaur like on the nose or something like totally weird like that. So they're often shown with these like very flexible tails, even though they actually weren't flexible at all in that distal part, in the sort of back half of the tail. So you could flex them from side to side at the front of the tail, but the tail club is actually really stiff. It wouldn't really have been like curved if you were looking at it in life. So what I found was that the earliest evidence for any part of a tail club is actually about 120 million years old, and it's found in this juvenile ankylosaur called Liaoningosaurus from China. And it has the very beginnings of that kind of stiffening of the tail. The next youngest specimen that has any evidence for a tail club is an animal called Gobiosaurus from the Gobi Desert. And the age on this one is a little bit confusing, but it was probably about 90 million years old, 90 or 92 million years old. So that's the next oldest or next youngest specimen. It has basically a fully developed tail club handle, but it doesn't look like it had any of those big knob osteoderms preserved at the end of it. But besides that, it looked a lot like what the ones from the more famous ankylosaurs like Ankylosaurus would have looked like. So most of the ankylosaurs that we think of as having tail clubs actually show up only kind of at the end of the Cretaceous period. Most of the ones that we're familiar with are from about 75 to 66 million years ago. So it's pretty cool to be able to show that The beginnings of the Tail Club started a long time before that. And it was also neat to show that it kind of evolved through this two-step process where the tail becomes stiff and then much later the osteoderms become really big.
Why would a feature like that evolve? What would is a possible function for the Tail Club?
So some of the work that I did as a master's student at the University of Alberta was looking at how ankylosaurs use their tail clubs. So I did some fun engineering simulations using finite element analysis to look at whether or not the tail club basically could have been used to smash into things. So to put it in a very technical term there. So that was a really cool project. A lot of people had suggested that that's what tail clubs are for, that they're for smashing into things, either for defending themselves from predators or whatever reason you want. And so I was able to show that that was plausible. Doesn't mean that they definitely did it, but they definitely could use their tail clubs for smashing into things. And it would probably have hurt a lot if they smashed a tail club into you.
Yeah. So
what's interesting, though, is that I think that it's not too hard to see how having a stiff tail is still a pretty good weapon, even if you don't have that knob of bone at the end. So it's kind of like a baseball bat rather than an axe. It would still hurt a lot to get smashed in the leg by a baseball bat, even if it wouldn't, like, chop your leg off, like if someone took an axe to you. So that's... So I feel like it's not too hard to picture these early ankylosaurs using those stiffened tails as a weapon and then gradually elaborating that by enlarging the osteoderms at the end of the tail.
Okay. So that's interesting because I was just thinking about what you said before about the flexibility. So obviously, I guess you don't think that they would do the scorpion tail kind of thing because it wouldn't be flexible that way. But.
Right. So ankylosaurs, they don't really have a lot of up and down mobility in the tail.
Okay.
They could have good side-to-side flexibility, but the vertebrae just aren't really configured to allow them a lot of, like, up and down movement. So it's not, like, zero movement, but if you see a picture where an ankylosaur has its tail, like, curled way up in the air, that's probably not right.
So thinking about flexibility kind of side-to-side... Would they have been able to move it? I guess from what you're suggesting is they would have been flexible enough to at least somewhat swing it, even if it wasn't that hard or that fast.
Yeah, definitely. So ankylosaurs still have kind of normal, flexible tail vertebrae at the front of the tail. So going from the pelvis back to about halfway down the tail,
okay.
They have sort of like typical dinosaur tail vertebrae that lets the tail move side to side. So when we're talking about the stiffening of the tail, we're really only talking about the last, the sort of back half or back third of the tail.
Okay. I'm just thinking about how heavy a structure like that would be. And even if it was flexible enough, you'd have to be able to, you know, have enough, I guess, sort of force and muscle to lift that up and swing it. So how would that work?
So there's a couple of things going on with ankylosaurs that I think help them use their tails in this way. So right, so now we're talking about the ones that have like the full tail club with like the stiff vertebrae and the knob of bone at the end. So yeah, having like a 60 centimeter wide like blob of bone way far away from the rest of your body is weird. Like you have to do something in order to make that like movable and carryable. So one of the things that ankylosaurs also have are really super wide hips. And since a lot of the muscles of the tail sort of originate and attach onto the hips, they probably had really, really big, like, butt muscles, basically, for swinging the tail back and forth. So I don't think that there's any issue there with having, like, the musculature needed to swing the tail from side to side.
Mm-hmm.
We know from other work that people have done that ankylosaurs had, or not just ankylosaurs, but dinosaurs as a whole, had chunky tails. They have lots of musculature in the tail. So definitely, I don't think that would have been a problem. Another cool thing about ankylosaurs is that running alongside the tail club in particular are lots of ossified tendons. So these are sort of tendons, which are normally like in our bodies, they're usually like elastic and flexible. Lots of dinosaurs ossify them or calcify them so that they become sort of hard and stiff. And one of the cool things about tendons is that they reduce the amount of like muscular effort you need to do certain things. So where you have tendons in your body really helps you sort of save energy. So things like kangaroos jumping, they have a whole series of tendons in their legs that store like elastic energy that helps them like spring along when they're bouncing. And we have the same thing like in our ankles and stuff like that. So having all of these tendons down in the sort of tail club region of the tail, I think would have probably helped them support it a little bit off of the ground so it wasn't just dragging. And I think that would have really helped with swinging because it would have been storing that elastic energy if they were swinging it from side to side.
That's really interesting. I hadn't actually thought about the sort of lifting it up and how difficult that would be in terms of muscle and just movement in general. So that's really interesting.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I've wondered is whether or not ankylosaurs might actually be one of the few kinds of dinosaurs that would actually drag their tail. Because when you start to get a tail that heavy, I haven't done the work on this, but I think it would be really interesting to figure out like how much muscular effort is required to hold something so large and heavy that distance from your body.
Yeah.
So did ankylosaurs, did that just not matter because of the way their muscles and bones were set up? Or maybe it actually did get really heavy and they did drag their tails. I don't think it's too crazy to think that they probably at least like rested their tail on the ground if they were just standing or browsing or grazing. But I don't really know. We don't have a lot of trackways for ankylosaurids. We do have footprint records for what are probably nodosaurids, and we don't have any tail drag marks for them. But we don't have as many definite ankylosaurid trackways. But that would be one way we could find out, because if we had ankylosaurid trackways with this like giant trough running down the middle, I think we could probably say that they were dragging their tail, but we just don't have that evidence right now. So it's one of those things that I think would be interesting to look at.
Are nodosaurid and ankylosaurids so different that you could tell from a trackway?
I think you might be able to. If we knew a little bit more about their hands and feet, that would probably be a little bit easier. We only really have good hand and foot material for a few species of ankylosaurids. So I think it would be a little bit trickier, but I think you could do it. It's all the same problems as you have for like any other trackway research, where so much of the interpreting the trackway has to do with the sediment and the substrate that it's walking on. So, but that's getting pretty far away from my area of expertise.
Yeah, yeah, it's just, so. Just a thought. I was thinking, would their feet be that different?
Right, right.
I guess kind of a sort of more popular science-y question is you often see, well, of course, you often see in movies and everything that they use their tails to defend themselves, and that may have been possible. But you also always see ankylosaurs as being these big, almost tank-like animals that are, you know, are completely impossible to move, basically. Were they as kind of successful at staying on their feet and not being eaten, do you think?
I like to think that ankylosaurs probably had a bad attitude and probably as adults didn't really have to worry about large predators unless they were ill or wounded, much like a lot of adult herbivores today that are large are not often predated upon by predators. So I especially like to think of ankylosaurs as having a kind of cantankerous attitude and for most predators to give them a wide berth, which is partly why Jurassic World made me so frustrated, because they all just ran away. I was like, no, don't run away. You're fine. You can take care of yourself. So in terms of how, so I guess we're thinking like cow tipping, like ankylosaur tipping in the Cretaceous. I don't know. They're pretty low to the ground. Their legs are pretty short. I feel like they would have been pretty sturdy and hard to tip over. But Tyrannosaurs are pretty big.
Yeah.
So I feel like a determined Tyrannosaur probably could tip one over if it really wanted to. But I think it would have to earn that.
Yeah. Just thinking about the kind of osteoderms again. Obviously, their backs are often covered in, you know, big spikes and stuff. And that's, does that go, like, is that almost similar to a turtle kind of shell where it's, you'd have kind of a big shield over the entire back, or is it just osteoderms in single places?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It's hard to describe ankylosaurs because there aren't really good examples of similar things today. So turtles, a lot of people ask me that. They ask me if ankylosaurs would have looked like turtles. And the answer is no. What ankylosaurs are doing is really different from what turtles are doing, mostly because turtles are really weird. So turtles are basically like pulling their ribs up and into like a new region of their body and then causing their back to ossify as the ribs start to turn into bone. So like turtles are just like the worst example because they're just so strange and weird. Like nothing is like a turtle really. But ankylosaurs also aren't really like armadillos because in armadillos, all of the osteoderms kind of like lock together with this little peg and socket articulation and form that like continuous shield. So ankylosaurs really have a slightly more flexible hide in some parts of their body. They've got, you know, usually like sort of rows of large kind of feature osteoderms that might be like keeled ovals or cones or spikes in some way. And then over the pelvis in some species, those osteoderms kind of fuse up into a continuous sheet. We call it a pelvic shield. And throughout the rest of the body, though, it doesn't look like they usually fused up to each other very much. So outside of the pelvis and these yolks of bone on the neck, there still would have been like flexible skin in between those osteoderms. Some ankylosaurs, though, in addition to those big osteoderms, they have like hundreds of thousands of little like millimeter sized osteoderms. I usually call them ossicles, forming almost like a pavement within the skin. So they're not fused up to each other, but there's tons of them. So they would have been really, really tough in their skin just overall.
Wow. I didn't realize that they had lots of little ones as well. I always think of it as just having a whole bunch of big ones and then something in between.
it's not like present. I don't think it's present in all of them, but in some of the ones from Alberta, like it looks like Scolosaurus and Euoplocephalus and Anodontosaurus at least, and Dioplosaurus. So the four kind of Campanian aged ones from Alberta had these little ossicles in their skin. So it's pretty cool. If you visit the Natural History Museum in London and look closely at the Scolosaurus there, you can see them underneath the scale impressions sometimes. And they're pretty cool. Basically little shiny black dots.
I'm going to have to look at that next time I'm there. I'm sure I've seen it before, but I can't remember actually looking at that.
So. Well, you have to look pretty closely to see them because they're not very big. Yeah. That's for sure.
Is that something that could be related to preservation? Because I can imagine that a lot of very small things like that might be easily lost. And is it something about the Alberta ones that maybe are preserving them better than others?
Yeah, I think that's definitely possible. One thing that's interesting, though, is from the specimens I've looked at, it doesn't really seem like those little ossicles are as common in some of the Mongolian ones that tend to be preserved with their armor in place. Okay. So I wouldn't say that they definitely don't have them. It's possible that some of them maybe have been prepared away, or maybe they're just not as abundant as in some of the Alberta ones, or it really might just be a preservational thing, but it seems like they're not as abundant and prominent in some of the other species outside of Alberta, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, no, that is interesting. Have you done any work, or has anybody done any work with kind of histology or looking at the sort of fine scale details of the osteoderms and what's kind of making them up and if they're different or similar to other things?
Yeah, there's been a couple of studies looking at osteoderm histology and texture in many different groups. And my colleague, Mike Burns, who was also a PhD student at the University of Alberta while I was there, he was doing a lot of work on osteoderm histology. And it's interesting because there are actually some differences between, say, nodosaurids and ankylosaurids. Hmm. But one thing that's really cool about osteoderms is when you cut them up and look at them as a thin section under the microscope, you can see this really cool, like, cross-hatching pattern, a very sort of fibrous texture that looks really different from like endoskeletal bone. So like the bone of like a leg or a rib or something. So they really are these kind of cool, unique structures in the skeleton, pretty different from the rest of the bones.
Hmm. And is that different or similar to any modern animals that might have like something like an armadillo or other armored things?
I probably should know the answer to that, but I don't off the top of my head. I think that ankylosaurs have a much more prominent sort of cross-hatching texture compared to something like an armadillo, but I definitely need to like pop open some papers and double check that to be confident about that.
I was just thinking about the osteoderms and thinking, you know, it's so much bigger than anything we have today and how that would potentially compare in terms of microstructure, but...
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, some of the osteoderms on ankylosaurs are, I think they're probably among the biggest like osteoderms of any animal. I mean, some of these spikes and, you know, the tail club knob, they're just so huge. They're just totally bizarre compared to like any other animals, even in the fossil record.
How big would the spikes have been?
So an animal called Edmontonia, which is from Alberta,
shocking,
has really huge spikes that sit on sort of over top of the shoulder. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to remember, I've measured a couple of them, but they're really big. They've got to be at least like 40 or 50 centimeters long, some of them. And they're solid. Some ankylosaurs have kind of hollowed out osteoderms, but these ones are basically like solid cones just about. Hmm. So that's a pretty substantial investment of bone in your body, not to mention all the rest of the osteoderms throughout it.
Yeah, and that would be an animal that's, what, 2-3 meters long?
Oh, Edmontonia is pretty big. It's got to be at least 3 meters long, if not more. I'm always really terrible at dinosaur lengths because I never have like complete ones.
Well, that's what I was thinking. How long is an ankylosaur? 2 meters seems like very long, but...
No, well, I know there are some tails that are like 2 or 3 meters long.
Okay.
So Edmontonia is definitely one of the bigger ankylosaurs. It's a nodosaurid, and it's definitely one of the bigger nodosaurids. So, I mean, it's got to be at least like 4 meters long, I would think.
So... kind of looking into the future, you said that you're starting to look a little bit more at nodosaurids now. So is that kind of the next thing to look at?
That's one of the things I'm looking at. So some of the things I'm interested in, besides tail clubs, are looking at dinosaur biogeography and understanding like why we find some species in some areas versus others. So it's kind of like a long-term goal of mine to understand the sort of distribution of ankylosaurids and nodosaurids globally. Mm-hmm. What I'm working on for my postdoctoral research in North Carolina, I think is really fun and cool. I'm looking at the evolution of weapons in extinct animals. Ah. So I'm looking at things like glyptodonts, which also have tail clubs and are kind of ankylosaur-esque in that they have a lot of armor and these cool tail clubs, but those are relatives of armadillos, so those are mammals. And I'm going to be looking at a special group of turtles called the Myelanian turtles. They're an extinct group that are basically ankylosaur convergent turtles. They've got like these cool horns on their head and they have tail clubs, and they're actually pretty big. They're really cool. So I'm going to be looking at things like, what does it take to evolve a tail weapon? What sorts of things preclude you from having a tail weapon? Do tail weapons follow the same steps that I saw for ankylosaurs in other groups? So do you always have kind of stiffening of the tail before sort of the addition of like an enlarged weapon at the end? And I'd also like to take a look at sort of tail weapons generally, not just tail clubs, but other animals that have tail weapons. So things like stegosaurs or some of the sauropods that have weird things going on with their tails. So it's becoming a really fun sort of comparative project and learning some new phylogenetic techniques, which are really cool. And I'm hoping to have some neat stuff to report on that in the not too distant future, hopefully.
Excellent. I look forward to hearing about that. Sounds like a really interesting project.
Yeah, I'm having a lot of fun with it, but I have to learn about mammals now. So I feel a bit of a treat to my dinosaur brethren.
Well, I think that that's great, Victoria. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with Joe Keating, Laura Soule and Liz Martin. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, with music supplied by the Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material for this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at @PaleoCast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.